Hello and welcome. It's episode 54 of Campbell Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell. Today's conversation is all about how to have better conversations. Now, the podcast is called Campbell Conversations. So to dive into this one, I really wanted to find an expert in this space. And we certainly managed to achieve that with Celeste Headley, award-winning journalist, professional speaker, and the author of a book that had a tremendous impact on my own ability to have conversations, We Need to Talk. During the episode, Celeste shares with us the power of listening before we really dive into her now famous TED Talk, which is over 23 million views, discussing 10 ways to have good conversation. This is really an episode that's going to help us build up on a skill which is incredibly underrated in the 21st century, and that is to sustain coherent, confident conversation. Try and say that three times quickly and you'll get your tongue tied in knots. During the episode, you're going to absolutely love the actionable takeaways. So if you've got a notepad or you've got your phone open, please take some notes, but obviously not if you are listening to this one while driving. I am pleased to say that this podcast today is brought to you by Suns, the first sponsored podcast that we've had so far in the series. And I'm delighted to be working with Suns, who are a men's health brand that help out with an area that many of us don't talk about. And that area is hair loss. Many of you know, if you've come across from Instagram, that I've talked more openly in recent months about my own experience with trying to hold on to the hair follicles on my head. And Suns is a brand I've been working with to do that. From a personal experience, I've taken finasteride for coming up for 7 years now, since the age of 21. And when I got the opportunity to work with a leading brand like Suns to promote the products that I have used myself and believe in, it was a bit of a no-brainer. Suns set themselves apart in this space by offering free online consultations with GPs. It is not based on mumbo jumbo or snake oil salesman tactics that you often see in the men's health and well-being space. This is a legit arrangement, otherwise they wouldn't be on my podcast. There's a number of different options available to you, so you can actually go through the online consultation with a GP, as I've said, and then you can make a selection on the package that you need. The package that I use is finasteride and minoxidil, which is effectively quite a strong combination to hold on to the follicles on your temple and at your crown. And for me, it's certainly been a benefit for the last 7 years. There's different plan options, and you can explore those on the website. And as a bit of an introductory offer, you've got the opportunity to get £20 off your first order with the code SUNSCAMBRO. The link will be in the bio for suns.co.uk. I'm delighted they've chosen to sponsor the podcast, and I'm delighted to bring to you a leading reputable brand with a solution to a problem that many of us guys don't want to talk about, but certainly do care about. Without any further ado, let's get into this episode with the brilliant Celeste Headley. Welcome back to another episode of Campbell Conversations. And today's conversation, funnily enough, we are talking about how to have better conversations that matter. To do so, we are joined by an expert in that field, award-winning journalist, professional speaker, and author, Celeste Headley. Celeste, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Delighted to have you. And for the listener's background, I was down the YouTube rabbit hole on all things conversations, social skills, and ability to hold good conversations, particularly as somebody that's trying to hold himself up as a podcast host now. And I stumbled across your now world famous TED Talk from back in 2015, I think. And it was 10 ways to have good conversations. And it's now over something like 23 million views and having significant impact. And it distills down nicely a lot of the principles which I've started to try and integrate. And it led me to diving into one of your books. And so I guess that's where I found you. However, I think for the listeners, it'd be helpful to give a bit of a background on when you started to take interest in conversations and listening and just generally being a good person to talk to.
Well, I mean, I think I'm like anybody else in that I thought I was a good conversationalist for most of my life. It wasn't until I became a a host, a presenter. I have worked for National Public Radio, which is our version of the BBC, for 20 years. And I wanted to become a better interviewer. And as I started to do research, a couple things struck me. First was that the advice that we'd been getting is pretty bad. And the reason I knew that is because, you know, I had a conversational laboratory in my studio, and I could try out the advice we got of, you know, maintain eye contact and say, and yeah, and nod your head. And I could try each one of those things out and see if they made things better or they didn't. And they almost universally made things worse. That was number one. And number two was that as I began to do research, as I began to go deeper and start to see, okay, so what do we actually know about good conversation? That's when I started to realize I was not as good at it as I thought I was. And I became really hyper aware of the mistakes I was making and how when conversations go bad, and I thought that was the other person's fault, it maybe wasn't entirely their fault. So that's sort of where that all began.
That's interesting. And I think one of the first things that jumped to mind when I was looking to get you on the podcast was around one of the things you said, and it's something I felt I was very guilty of, was when you're listening to somebody else speak, so your dialogue there, you're thinking about what you're going to say next. And that's such a common trait in face-to-face real life conversations or Zoom conversations, as many of us are doing during COVID for work and whatnot. And it's really funny because it means that you don't necessarily absorb the things that you've actually said, so you can come back in a meaningful way, whereas you're just thinking about, oh, how can I sound clever, or how can I sound correct or informed, kind of almost regardless of what you've said, which is a terrible position to end up in.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, that gets worse. That tendency becomes more pronounced in smarter people. Like, the smarter you are, the more likely you are to not listen to what someone's saying. And, you know, a few reasons. One is that smart people, you know, they know a lot of stuff, and they want to share that wisdom with other people. But also, they assume they know what the other person's saying, right? Somebody gets maybe 10 words into their part of the conversation, and you go, oh yeah, I know. And then you're just waiting for them to stop talking so you can answer back. It's super common. It's common among all of us. And it's, you know, it does mean that you're not listening. You're not actually listening. And I mean, just to give people an out here, listening is hard. That was one of the aha moments for me when I was doing research, was discovering that listening is hard. It always has been hard. It predates our difficulty in listening. It's just a Homo sapiens thing, right? It predates our technology. So it's not just you, it's us. The call is coming from inside the house.
I think the fact that you highlighted their technology is really important, because a lot of us would maybe jump on the bandwagon of blaming social media or smartphones and how they grab our attention, and that's why we're not listening to people around us. Now, that's maybe a vehicle that our poor listening is kind of transferred through at the moment. However, like you say, throughout human history as Homo sapiens, we have listened poorly, regardless of whether we had an iPhone in our hand, or regardless of whether it was, I don't know, the fire that we were making to cook the beast that we just caught in the wild. So it's always been the case, like you say, and that really interested me, that we can put things in place around technology to limit the fact that we're on our phones when we're with our partner or with our friends, but it's not fundamentally just a quick fix in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, getting rid of your phone is essential. You will not be able to listen with it there, right, with it visible. But that's not going to solve your problem, right? If you're a bad listener, then getting rid of your technology is not suddenly going to make you a good listener. It really does require effort. I mean, so much so that active listening burns a trace amount of glucose, you know, not enough to help anybody lose weight. But it's just an example of how it really truly is an effort. It does require effort on your part to focus that well. And it also means that, you know, nobody's going to get done listening to your podcast and be like, okay, from now on, I'm going to be a great listener. It's just not going to happen like that. You have to think of it more like a discipline, more like going to the gym, that it's a constant work in progress.
Yeah, thanks for linking that back to fitness, because many of the listeners are extremely interested in their fitness and they're very passionate about it. So it's always helpful when we can give relatable examples around. So recently we had a confidence coach on who spoke about training confidence like a muscle. Let's train listening like a muscle. Let's train our ears and our minds. And I guess a kind of really common phrase that I was always kind of drilled into me as a child is we have 2 ears and one mouth for a reason. Where does your head sit with respect to that quote?
Yeah, and you know, we've had even, you know, versions of that quote from all different kinds of cultures, right? You know, Buddha said, if you're talking, you're not learning, right? It obviously, it's a good visual that you should be listening twice as much as you speak. And that sounds facile, right? But the research bears this out. They even just had a research study come out like maybe a year and a half ago that showed that you can predict your enjoyment of a conversation by how much time you spend listening as opposed to talking. This is a little bit complicated, so I want to drill down on this. There is an enjoyment that you get out of talking about yourself. It fires up your dopamine. That's the addiction hormone. It gives you this short little burst of pleasure. And as I said, it's the addicted hormone. It gives you the same type of pleasure you get if you take a shot of heroin. It's very addictive. You can become literally compulsive about talking about yourself. But there's this other pleasure that you get from listening and from hearing other people's stories. And that involves serotonin and oxytocin. Those are the mommy's hug hormones, right? Those are the longer lasting ones. And when you activate those hormones, that's a long lasting pleasure. Not only that, but it does great things to your mood. It makes you more compassionate when you have those hormones in control of your brain. It makes you more generous. It makes you more patient. So in terms of what, if you want to be a better person, talking about yourself will give you a short burst of pleasure, but being a better person requires you to listen.
We're all about delayed gratification in this audience, Celeste, so you're speaking the right language to us in terms of that longer term fix of serotonin over dopamine, that longer term fix of deep connection over short bouts of pleasure or whatever it is. So I think you're definitely speaking the right language to us. I know from my research getting prepared for this podcast that you came from a musical background, and it runs in the family as well in terms of a very strong heritage there. How much of a role do you think that played in your ability to improve your listening ability?
I think musicians are one of the very few professions in which listening training is required, right? There's not a lot of them other than, say, counseling, therapy, where you literally have to take courses in how to listen, in which you literally cannot do your job if your listening skills are not good, right? Not just the tuning of your instrument, or in my case, your voice, but the rhythms, how everyone else is breathing. If you're in a choir, you're going to hear people's breathing, and then your breathing will even get in tune there. Your listening skills become very, very highly tuned. Also, I might mention, if you want to practice music, it is also one way to increase your empathy, just FYI, especially singing and performing in groups like a choir or a band. But yeah, I think the music had a lot to do with it. It's funny, I think that I learn more about people from the rhythm of their speaking than even the words they choose. Everybody has a rhythm, right? And when you go to different cities, you'll hear the different rhythms. It's very different rhythm between London and Dublin. It's a very different rhythm between New York and Los Angeles. And it sort of reflects the way of life. And that's one thing that you sort of learn as a musician that I doubt many other people study.
That's really interesting. What do you think we could implement for us non-musical types immediately, or not immediately, but longer term?
Actually, you can implement it immediately. One of the exercises I train people in terms of improving your listening is listening to the tone of someone's voice. So you could take all of the punctuation out and the consonants out of somebody's listening, and you could hear whether they were angry or sad or focused just based on the tone that they're using, right? So one of the things that you can do is learn to figure out, I guess, the aura of the pronunciation of a word. For example, if you said to me, Celeste, do you want to be on my podcast? And I said, maybe. Right, that's no. That's a no. Not going to happen. But I say, maybe. Right? It's a completely different tone. And if you can start training yourself to listen for the tone of people's voices, you can do that immediately. And here's another example I give all the time is like, have you ever called up a friend and all they said was hello and you said, what's wrong? Right? That's how quickly you can hear some, quite frankly, really complicated information just in the tone of somebody's voice. What did you hear? Was it their intonation? Was it their breath? What was it you were hearing? We don't know. But we know that when you're tuned into the sounds of a person, you're getting some incredibly sophisticated information about them.
I like that as an actionable step straight away that we can move forward with. And like you say, sometimes for a person that we know particularly well and we just hear them speak, we know immediately what their mood is, how they're feeling, how with your maybe you can straight away gauge how somebody's actually feeling rather than what their words are necessarily telling you, as you've said there. So tonality is something we can focus on straight away. And sometimes, like you say, we're probably very good listeners. Like you say, when we pick up the phone to a friend and we hear them say hello in a particular tone, you know something's wrong. But sometimes we're not tuned in enough to pick up on that and we miss it.
That's exactly right. Another thing is I can tell if one of my employees is anxious because their breath moves up here, right? And I'll say, how are you doing? They're like, fine. And I can see that they need to go home, right? Something has gone wrong. And that's another way in which you can use a musician's techniques and get in tune with somebody's sounds, the sound of a person. And you can do this preemptively, right? Like, you don't have to wait till someone's upset. You can get to hear what do they sound like when they're relaxed. And that will mean that you will be more tuned in to figure it out when they're not relaxed anymore.
Yeah, of course. I think before we dive into your 10 ways, Celeste, and we've covered a little bit around listening there, let's set the scene in terms of conversations within the 21st century. We've mentioned smartphones, we've mentioned technology. One of the things I've heard you speak about before is how potentially polarized we are and how there's very few safe subjects, and how potentially one of the greatest skills that we can have is the ability to sustain a coherent, confident conversation with another individual, because actually it's quite a challenge for many people. That's why not everyone has a successful podcast. Not everyone has successful relationships. Not everyone has successful careers and work, because they haven't been able to have those conversations. Let's set the scene a little bit and you can bring the people into where your head was at when you thought, right, we really need to tackle this.
Well, you know, I'm a journalist, and one of the things that made me concerned about our level of discourse, not just in the US, but worldwide, was the fact that we aren't able to talk about things we disagree on anymore. Here in the US, politicians would fight with each other on the House of the Congress, and they would then go to each other's kids' birthday parties and have dinner together and talk about regular stuff. Now we seem to think that talking to someone is endorsement. Simply saying, how's your day? It's fine. How are you? That is us validating someone else's opinion. And it's just not. Listening to someone is not an endorsement. And I think that this is sort of what brought me here, is because as a journalist, I have been able to watch the disintegration of civil discourse. That we get on our principles, we stand on our principles, and we will not listen. We decide, have this long list of people we won't listen to. And it's tearing us apart. Partly because if you never talk about politics or religion with people you disagree with, it means you know very little about politics and religion.
Yeah, that echo chamber effect, isn't it? Where if you only ever hear your own side's views, you become more and more entrenched. And even if you were to challenge yourself slightly with somebody who is amenable to a measured conversation, you might take on board some of them. They're not going to change you fully from Republican to Democrat or Conservative to Labour or whatever the dividing line is in your politics. But you might understand more of their viewpoint. You might accept elements of it, or you might just be able to be civil in the street to each other rather than the current situations that we sometimes fall into.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. I have been working for a while now on a book on how to talk about race. And one of the things I say is, look, try to find common ground. obviously trying to find stuff that you agree on. But if you can't find anything you agree on politics or race, then talk about pizza, talk about tacos, talk about dogs, right? Talk about something, anything on which you could create some kind of empathic bond and recognize your shared humanity with another person. You're not doing anything for them. That doesn't equate to a donation to their GoFundMe page. You're just making yourself and them better.
Yeah, fully on board with that, Celeste. With this backdrop of us being more divided than ever before, a bit of hostility in terms of not being able to have conversations about key issues, let's dive into those 10 ways initially of how to go forward. And I think the first one, if I'm not incorrect, is around presence.
Yeah, it's really common for me to say that people need to be present in a conversation, and they say, oh, I know, I need to put down my cell phone. And yes, you do. You don't need to just put it down. You need to put it out of your line of sight, because research has showed that even having it in your peripheral vision interferes with your ability to have a good conversation. But it's not just that. It's about being there in that moment, not thinking about what you're going to watch on Netflix, not thinking about all the other stuff. Every time, you know, oftentimes when we're in a conversation with someone, they start talking and we use that as a moment to go over what we need to get done at work. You know, you need to be present. And if you can't be present, it's important you be honest about that and say, listen, I can't focus on this right now, and you deserve my focus. So let's come back to this. The whole point being, give them your full attention. And frankly, sometimes we don't do that because we think it'll take too much time. But if you're actually listening in a focused way, the conversation takes less time.
Yeah, that's a huge point, isn't it? We're able to get our point across much more clearly if everyone's on the same page and understands. And that comes from that L word, which you banged on about at the start, and I'm fully on the same page, listening. If we listen and we're present, you and I can have a much better chat, because I think it's interesting from my experience doing podcasts, and I know we'll get on to don't tell too many stories in terms of this, but I find it fantastic to have this present conversation, because you and I are doing nothing else at the moment. We're completely focused on this chat. And that's the reason that people listen to podcasts so often, because they like the fact that the two participants are going back and forth, completely engaged in the topic. Nobody's quickly checking what's happening on their right. chat, or they're quickly checking the Twitter feed. They're just chatting back and forth, and it's really engaged. So I really like that presence as a first point for us to really improve our conversations.
Yeah, I agree. And again, it's more efficient than that. You don't need a half hour conversation. Sometimes people set up, you know, 2 hour meetings or something. If everyone was listening, you don't need the 2 hour meeting, guaranteed.
What on, Celeste? So if I take you onto number two, and the term pontificate appears, talk the listeners through what you mean by that.
So pontificating just means lecturing people, trying to educate them. This is, you know, hold forth. We often see, in fact, the most common type of conversation that I listen in on, and I'm constantly listening in on the conversations around me, is one in which this person wants to tell them what they think and believe, and then this person wants to say, well, this is what I think and believe, and they could have the conversation alone, right? That's how little they're responding to what the other person says. But the fact of the matter is that none of us like that. We don't enjoy it when other people tell us what to do. Research has shown there's only two instances in which a conversation is not beneficial for your well-being. One is when it's hostile, no surprise. The other is when we're getting advice of any kind, even when we'd asked for it. We hate it. So if you are giving someone advice, then they're shutting down. They're not listening to you anymore. And the same is sort of true. That sort of category of advice goes for all the times when you're trying to educate something, or when you're, you know, correcting the record. You know, actually, it's not champagne if it doesn't come from this specific region of France, right? They aren't going to listen to you. You're wasting your breath.
Yes, that lecturing piece, pontificating, is an interesting one, because a lot of the time we feel that it's really important we get our point across, or we make that correction, like you said, whereas you're saying there straight away, there's two instances where people come away from the conversation with no dopamine and no serotonin, and they feel terrible, or they feel less. And one of those is when I correct you or try to teach you something that
Yeah.
Sometimes when even when you've asked for it. So that certainly educates me in that respect.
Yeah, it's there's no point. And the other thing is that if you're trying to change their opinion, which is so common these days, give it up. It's not going to work. I mean, honestly, when was the last time you had a conversation with someone about something, a strongly held belief, in which you gave them all your statistics and your data and you told them all your facts and they were like, oh, you are so right. I have completely changed my mind. Oh my God, I was absolutely wrong. I mean, come on.
It just doesn't happen, does it? It
doesn't happen. No.
No, so point two there, do not pontificate, don't lecture. Instead, steer away from those conversations because ultimately neither of you are going to come out with any form of constructive, positive feelings around that at all. Point three is around questions and how we lead a conversation, so to speak. Can you talk me through that a little bit, please, Celeste?
Yeah, and this comes straight out of journalism. Not just journalism, also in terms of trying to come up with good questions, I've studied law enforcement, you know, their interrogatory techniques. Some of the greatest questions I actually found Robert Mueller, who was the special investigator here investigating Donald Trump and the Russian interference in the election. That report is a great example of good questions, good open-ended questions. And an open-ended question is not one that can be answered with yes or no, right? A open-ended question is, it's simple, it's direct, and it must be answered with a real response, not weren't you afraid? Yes, I was afraid, but how did you feel, right? Not don't you have enough money? Yes or no? But instead, how are your finances? And in journalism, a lot of open-ended questions are interrogative led, meaning they begin with who, what, where, when, why, or how. But another sort of guideline here is to steer away from questions that begin with a verb. Is that what you should be doing? versus why are you doing that? When you begin with a verb, very often it can come off as passive aggressive. So, you know, you're not going to be able to make every single question fit these guidelines, but you should try.
Yes, exactly. And I think when you say around that passive aggressive piece, Celeste, we've got that. It's almost a leading question in terms of I'm telling you that my opinion is you shouldn't be doing that. So I'm saying, Should you be doing that?
Exactly.
It's a terrible
should
one.
Should you be wearing that?
Yes, exactly. So it's really negative. And I like the fact that how is the one that I always jump to. So away from podcasting and potentially sometimes taking my top off on Instagram through fitness, I work in the business development space in corporate insurance. And all my meeting prep and questions, most of the questions were trying to use funnels and move people along to different areas and explore things. And it's all about open-ended. Don't ask, are you happy with your insurance broker at the moment? Because it's a yes or no. How did your last renewal go? Is much more wide open and you can explore the avenues there. So I think, I guess that's maybe things that I've had through my own sales training, but and I did a little bit of journalism when I was at university as well. So I guess maybe I've had a little bit of a grounding in that one. So that one didn't shock me too much, but I think there's so much there where people have maybe fallen into a habit of always asking yes, no questions, that will maybe be something that people can immediately action and change.
I agree. When you ask yes or no questions, it allows you to maintain control of the conversation because you're basically shutting down their ability to respond, but it's not a great way to have a conversation.
Yeah. So point four takes us to go with the flow. Hopefully this is flowing okay because we've got an order to this, but talk to me a wee bit more about going with the flow.
Okay, so there's a soundtrack, or I guess a monologue going on in your head at all times. Your brain is constantly thinking. You can't stop it from thinking, right? Sometimes people will say, clear your mind. And I always laugh because that's ridiculous. That's not going to happen. And there's two ways in which that inner monologue can mess up, right? One of them is when you're talking, which we'll get to in one of the next points. The other is when you're listening. And that's what this point is about. So in other words, when you're listening to somebody else, there's an inner monologue going on inside your head. And what happens is we sometimes get distracted by that inner monologue. So I think the example I gave in the TED Talk, forgive me, it's been some years since I wrote it and did it, was something like, you're at the, somebody says, oh, I saw Ellen DeGeneres at the coffee shop. Or they'll say, here's what it was. It was, I was at the coffee shop and I got myself a latte. And you remember the time you saw Ellen DeGeneres at the coffee shop and you hear nothing else they say, right? Yeah. You're just holding on to this thought that has arisen in your mind and waiting for them to stop talking so you can insert your little piece. But the thing of it is, this information that you're getting from your mind is for you, right? Your brain is constantly going through the archives. It's like a research librarian. It's digging up facts. It's digging up material to try and help give you context and information about what's going on. Almost none of it is supposed to be shared. It's supposed to be like, you know, CNN at the airport. It's just always on and it should never be paid attention to, right? It just leave it in the background. So what we have to do in order to go with the flow is learn to let those thoughts come in and let them go out so we can return to the flow of conversation. Otherwise, you're damming up the works, right? You are not listening. You're sort of stopping the conversation so you can hold on like death grip to this story, which, let's be honest, you have probably told that story 12 times before. You don't need to tell it again.
Yes, and because all you're thinking about is this anecdote that you want to share off the back of that, you might miss the second half of that sentence, which is really interesting about the coffee they just got, and you can then go from there and develop a much deeper conversation that works both ways, rather than that dopamine hit of the kind of cheap short-term thrill of saying, oh, when I was in that coffee shop, I met X, Y, or Z. And
exactly.
It doesn't mean anything to the other person unless they're a huge Ellen DeGeneres fan, and you can go from there. But that's either lucky or unlucky.
Yeah, exactly. So, exactly. So, but that's, it's difficult. I mean, what I'm telling people to do is simple. It's basically letting thoughts come in and let them go out, but it's not easy. You know, like, this is all what mindfulness meditation is about, right? Learning to let thoughts come and learning to let them go. It's challenging.
I guess it does link to that presence piece as well, doesn't it? Around, like you say, when we're having this discussion and I'm immediately thinking of an anecdote that I'm going to try and share off the back of something you've prompted, instead letting it go, as you say, from a meditation example, and focusing on what's being said, because ultimately the conversation is going to be more rewarding if I respond accordingly, rather than responding with, oh, but I think this because you've said that. And it's very much bringing yourself into it rather than listening to what's been said and responding for them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly so.
So moving forward, admitting you don't know, this is a hard one for many of us. Where did that idea come to you from?
Well, it partly comes from being a journalist and having people refuse to say, I don't know, on the air. You'll ask them a question. And I've gotten to the point now where I will say, before I interview someone, it's okay to tell me you don't know. It's okay. If I ask you something you don't know, please just tell me. Don't guess. You know, it's interesting because research in the medical field shows that doctors guess all the time. All the time. They find it so scary to say, I don't know what's wrong with you, that they guess. And the medical field would really like them to stop doing that, right? I mean, obviously. So they have run a series of studies to try to get doctors to learn how to say, I don't know. And one that I feature in the book is one in which they had some people continuing to do their guessing, and the other half, they forced them to say, I don't know, but I'll find out, just for like a period of months. That's your answer when you aren't sure. And those doctors found out that their patients had a higher estimation of their intellect, of their experience, of their knowledge, because, and here's why, we all know that not everybody can know everything. We know that. So when someone has an answer for everything and someone has an opinion on everything, subconsciously we know that some of that is bullshit. Sorry, can I swear?
Or she can. We're authentic here, Celeste. That's a part of this, isn't it? Good conversation. To be the real you.
Right. So some of that is bullshit. We just don't know which. So when you constantly pretend to knowledge you don't have, what you're doing is eroding trust. So if you don't know, and let me be clear, reading two paragraphs of an article off of Facebook is not the same as knowing. If you don't know, it's okay. Just say, I don't know.
Yeah, I find that so valuable. And like you say, you maybe reassure interviewees beforehand that I'd much rather you said you don't know. The audience will respect you more. I'll respect you more. And we can go into another line of questioning. We can go into another area that you can add value in, or you can give us a valuable answer in, rather than you putting a finger in the air, waiting hoping something sticks, or throwing enough excrement in the wall and hoping it sticks to it in the right way. So I really like that whole almost leaving the ego at the door and admitting that I'm not sure about that subject. And I think the doctor's example, the second one that they do, is very valuable, because you're reassuring them, you don't know, but don't worry, like I will look into this and I'll move forward. And again, to bring it back to a business example, in a meeting, if I'm with a steel manufacturer, there's going to be things they tell me because they've been doing it for 20 years that I don't understand about their business. So I have to quite simply say, oh, I didn't know about that. Can you tell me a bit more about that? Or I don't know about that, but let me look into it. I've got a colleague that looks after three other steel manufacturers, and I can ask them. And rather than me losing face through maybe putting my foot in my mouth and saying something really silly, and then straight away they're like, that boy, yeah, nice guy, knows a lot about the subjects we talk about, until he told us this about our process, and he just bluffed his way through it, and you lose trust. Is that what you said?
I mean, we all know how stupid it sounds when someone uses a big word the wrong way. You know what I mean? And they sound stupid. This is kind of the same thing when you're pretending to know stuff you don't know. And frankly, this happens to me all the time in journalism or in radio. Well, people are like, whoa, yeah, I did radio in college. And they'll say something and I'll be like, that was dumb. That's not at all how it works. I mean, I don't say that out loud, but pretending to know stuff, it doesn't help you look smarter.
Yeah, I think in your role as an interviewer as well, you'll have done your research like I've done on you, Celeste, and you've done your research on maybe who you're speaking to. And there'll be elements of their subject area that you know really well, but there'll be elements where if they maybe came back at you with a particular term, you would need to ask them to explore it. And rather than you thinking and carrying on down the same line of questioning with a kind of preconceived idea of what they've spoken about, you can just eat humble pie, so to speak, and say, oh, okay, you mentioned pontification perhaps. A lot of the listeners would say, well, does that mean lecturing? I'm not sure, but you've elaborated on that, and it's put us in a much better position where your message is much more understandable and people are able to take a lot more action on it, rather than us just pontificating with large words if we needed to.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, especially in the interviewer's point of view, my research that I do is just so I can ask them good questions. Right. I brought them in to be an expert. I was a co-host of a show with someone who was always pretending he knew as much as his subject. And so, you know, we had Neil deGrasse Tyson in, and my co-host is sitting there telling Neil deGrasse Tyson how much he knows about astrophysics. I was thinking, Neil deGrasse Tyson is not going to be impressed by your knowledge. I mean, that's not going to happen. And that's sort of the same thing with any weather is that, you know, it's unlikely that an interviewer is going to impress me with their knowledge of broadcast journalism. Like, it's very unlikely. So, you know, let me be the expert in the things that I'm an expert, and I will let you be in the expert in the things in which you're an expert.
Yeah, accepting where your own wheelhouse is. And I suppose that leads us into number six in terms of equating experience with the other conversation.
Yeah, it's related. This is particularly related to times when someone is telling you about struggle or pain or a difficult situation. There's a few things going on here. The first thing is that when someone is telling you about something that is painful to them, something they're struggling with, sometimes we don't know what to say. And so we default to the topic that we know most, which is ourselves. And so that bleeds into this delusion that we have that telling people stories from our own lives builds empathy. That's what it feels like to us. It feels like when someone says, oh, my dog died, that if we say, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, when my dog died a couple of years ago, I had so much trouble getting over it. That feels like we're establishing empathy, but that's one-sided. The only person getting good feelings from that story you're sharing is you, not them. And we know this because we now have fMRIs. We now have functional magnetic resonance imaging machines. We know what's going on in people's brains. And so that empathy is not actually empathy. It's just dopamine. So you're not creating sort of this compassionate bond with someone else by sharing your own experience. What you're doing is turning the camera to yourself. and turning the attention to yourself and your own story when what they need most from you in that moment is just your listening. Meaning, ironically, you don't know what to say, and that means it's best to say nothing.
Yeah, and this out of the 10 was in the top two that I found the most contrary to what I thought previously, because I thought shared experience, bringing my experience and trying to be on your level and equate what we've not necessarily equate what we've gone through, because obviously people go experience things very differently, but trying to relate back so that, oh, it's okay, what you're going through is normal because I went through this too. I suppose there's an element within that, but it's not, because you're turning the camera back on you. That's a perfect phrase to, no, it's my mic. I want to talk now. It's a bit unhealthy.
And it's interesting because it also sort of leads us back to the thing about pontificating, about lecturing, because the underlying text, when you say, oh, I went through this and here's what I did, the underlying text is you're saying, this is what you should do. And they don't need your advice right then. Not only that, but the situations are not the same. And what worked for you may not work for them, right? So it's if you're invited to give your own story, if they say, oh, you know, I know you've been through this, what happened with you? Then absolutely have at it. But other than that, you're never going to regret not telling that story and drawing attention to yourself. That's never going to cause a problem. Whereas jumping in there with your story of the time your dog died, or you lost your job, or, you know, you were pulled over by the cops or whatever it was, that's most likely going to be unhelpful.
Yeah, it's a little bit of kind of belittling their experience, because it might almost be a one-upmanship case of, oh, you lost your job? Well, I lost my job when I had 3 dependents. And it's
right.
Oh, so I felt so much worse. So you don't have anything to be upset about. It's a funny one, isn't it? And I think a lot of people listening, that out of the ones we've discussed so far, might be something new for them to hear. And it certainly was new for me, and something that I've tried to step back from and really take on board what somebody else's own experience is, and only put forward my own experience if asked, or trying to give an example on a podcast, of course. So number 7, try not to repeat yourself. Let's not go round and round in circles.
Oh, it's so hard. And look, I'm a parent, so this one was so tough for me to accept. Because, and I'm just not a parent, but a boss. And you think that by repeating stuff, you're drilling it into their heads, but it's just not the way that it works. By repeating stuff, the person who's more likely to remember it is me, the person talking. That's the way the brain works. But we're not actually helping them remember. So, you know, saying, hey, have you taken out the trash yet? Hey, I noticed the trash isn't out yet. Hey, are you going to take out the trash? Not going to work. In fact, it's accomplishing the opposite of what you want. What's happening is you're training them not to listen to you. And this is one thing, again, that we know through study, is that when you are someone who repeats yourself a lot, people subconsciously know this, they learn this about you, and so they tune you out almost immediately because they know that you will say it again. I mean, if you think, you know, about a military leader, they don't say things more than once, right? That's because everyone in their command knows they're not going to repeat it, and they need to listen the first time. So, you know, don't repeat yourself.
Yeah, that's a wonderful example there in the military. Like you say, it's delivered once. You have to be attentive to that. Otherwise, you don't know what the order is because they're not going to repeat. Certainly one for us to take forward. Repetition has value in some places, the gym perhaps, but not in terms of as a boss. And give a little bit of an anecdote for us, Celeste. I recently had my manager promoted to lead a new division in another area of the UK. And we had due to COVID, we had his leaving night over Zoom. And it was very much a case of, we had a slide with like Martinisms, basically talking about all the different things that he would regularly say. And it was the way he would open meetings, some of the phrases he would use. And because they were repeated so often, they were stuck in our heads, but they were almost like a bit of a joke, and a bit of a stick to beat him with as he was leaving. It was a little bit of fun, but certainly things that he continued to repeat.
Yeah.
Number 8, coming up for the last of our few points to improve the ways we have conversations, is stay out of the weeds. Too much detail isn't important.
So remember I said that your inner monologue hurts you in 2 ways. The first one was it hurts you when you're listening. This is how it hurts you when you're talking. So you, while you're sitting there talking, your brain is going to come up with all kinds of details that are for your benefit, and you have to be careful not to add them into what you're saying, right? So if you said, "Hey, Celeste, I found your TED talk. I think you did it in 2015," I'd be like, "Oh, actually, I think it was 2014 because that was right after I took this job in Atlanta. And then, oh, no, wait. Okay, wait. I started in Atlanta in June, and then, well, I mean, technically, I started in March, but then I didn't actually move. I mean, nobody is listening to that.
You're in the
But these are
weeds.
exactly, you're in the weeds. All of these details are coming up in my head. They are for me." So those details are 100% boring and awful and deadly to a conversation. And you have to learn how to, again, ignore them when your brain offers them. It's very helpful. Thank you, brain. I'm not going to articulate that.
Again, I think a lot of us in recent years have maybe done like personality tests where we get split into quadrants and you've got red, blue, yellow, green, or whatever. And depending on what test you do, it will fall into different ones for each one. But certainly, there's maybe like one quadrant who really value detail. So maybe you telling me that if I was a blue, perhaps with the test that I did, I would really value you telling me, oh, so that TED talk was in March 2015. It was at this venue. I know that because X, Y, and Z, I would value that. Whereas the other three quadrants where millions of other people fall into are saying, why are you telling me this? I just care about the fact that you did a TED talk and I care about the topic rather than when it was and how it all went.
Yeah, although it's the number of people who are really interested in those names and dates is extremely small, especially in a conversation. They may be interested in reading it in a book, you know, if that's their topic, but in when you're having an exchange with someone else, it's it, that you're talking about a tiny, tiny percentage of people. They want to keep, you know, you have to think of the conversation like a shark, right? It has to move forward or it dies. And those conversations are keeping it in place. They're
Yeah,
impeding movement.
that's a lovely kind of visual analogy there, isn't it? In terms of, like you say, we're putting up barriers by bringing too much meat to the bones and too much detail in that respect. Now, number nine, we've talked at length already around listening, and I'll share a quote that I saw when I was prepping for the podcast. It's from James Clear, the author of Atomic Habits, and I'm on his email list, and he drops some bombs every Thursday, and he said that maturity is learning how to listen when we feel like talking. And the number of times since listening to your TED talk and reading your book, I've tried to bite my tongue when somebody else is talking because I've been like, just listen, just listen. Something more valuable is going to come from them than me interjecting at this point.
Has it worked out for you? Have you heard some interesting stuff?
Yeah, 100%. And now it's my turn to curse. So one of the best podcasters I listen to is Chris Williamson, who has Modern Wisdom. It's a UK podcast. And he said as a tip in a Q&A, employ the subtle art of shutting the fuck up. And it's so true as a podcaster because if somebody listens back to this and they heard my voice more than the expert, Celeste Headlee, that I brought on to talk about conversations, then we've done this podcast wrong.
Yeah, although how common is that, right? Especially when there's like celebrity podcasters. I mean, they're lucky because they are celebrities, so people do want to listen to them. But I listen to them with the ear of an interviewer, and I'm like, you suck. Like, you're terrible interviewer. Because all we're hearing are your stories. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it learning how to be quiet. I mean, it's so hard, but it's so freaking rewarding. And I don't mean rewarding in terms of like what I was talking about before, your serotonin, your oxytocin, but I mean rewarding in that it has long-term benefits. If you are the type of person who is a better listener, it generally that's generally associated with a higher IQ. It's generally associated with someone with more empathy. It's also generally associated with people who are more creative and innovative as well. Why? Because we're hearing tons of cool stuff. You already know everything you're going to say. You know already everything that is going to come out of your mouth. Nothing that you say is going to surprise you. So if you want to be surprised, you have to listen to other people.
Yeah, you're not going to learn anything new when you open your mouth, but you'll
Right.
definitely potentially learn something new, or very likely learn something new from somebody else if you keep quiet and bite your tongue and listen. Yeah, I love that, Celeste. And I think when it comes to listening, do you think one of the challenges with that is we have a fear of silence because I'm sure you've been on podcasts where maybe the host, or maybe you've been on the other side when you've been interviewing, where somebody takes their time between sentences to deliver. Maybe their tone and their rhythm is slower, and you feel that this gap is hard to deal with, and you want to go in.
Oh yeah, that used to be the case all the time. One of my mentors was a guy who used to, a Canadian who used to work for the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting, and he had trained me very carefully to keep my mouth the frick shut. And I remember I was doing a story about there was an exhibit in Michigan where they were getting photos and stories from all the surviving Holocaust survivors, all the people that were still alive. And I was walking through the gallery, and one of them whose picture was on the wall came in. And I said to him, he said, you know, my family has never known any of this stuff. I told them this for this exhibit, but I didn't tell my family any of these stories. And I said, why would you not tell your family about what happened to you? And it was this long pause. I mean, over a minute. And if you're in podcasting, you know how excruciating a minute of silence is. And he finally said, would you tell your children they murdered kids right in front of you? Would you tell your children that they starved grandmothers to death? And he started describing all this stuff. And it was one of the most rewarding, an immediate reward for patience. And I think for me, I keep that in the back of my head all the time, that what if I hadn't had patience? What if I'd interrupted him right before he got there? And this is true all the time. Yes, it is true that people struggle because they don't like silence, but it's also, we like to talk. You know, we like to talk. We like to talk about ourselves.
Of course. And I think that's such a brilliant example that through your delayed gratification and patience, you received the reward. You received the gratification of a pretty sensational discussion and admission from this gentleman who had so much to talk about, but he just needed time to get there. And when he did, he delivered in full and absolutely action-packed and valuable. Last, but by no means least, be brief. And the anecdote you gave for this, Celeste, I'm sure it'll be at the front of your mind, was extremely amusing when I first heard it.
Are you talking about the quote?
Yes, around ladies' wear.
Yeah, and I should say, since you're in the UK, that's an adaptation of a Winston Churchill quote. In terms of that, it should be like a mini skirt, short and long enough to cover the subject, but short enough to keep our interest. Yeah, that is an adaptation of something that Winston Churchill said, but it is slightly tinges of sexist joke that just reminds us that you don't need to go on and on. The fact of the matter is that, like it or not, our attention spans are shorter, and they're getting shorter all the time. And so if you go on at length, you're just going to lose people's attention. That's just the truth.
Yeah, I think if we relate it to like captions or discussions that maybe content creators put out there, you do see that kind of famous comment, too long, did not read. So the same applies to conversations as well. Too long, tuned out, wasn't listening to the end of it because you went on and on, you droned, and I'm lost. We're not.
You lost me, right? You lost me. Yeah. Exactly.
So that wraps up our 10 ways to have better conversations. I think the conversation at the start around how we can listen better is something that will really resonate with a lot of people. And then those 10 actionable ways to move forward with, certainly some challenging ones in there, particularly around number 6, equating your experience with others. I certainly thought I was being empathetic and building connection, but it turned out I was turning the camera back on myself. And really, unless asked about my own experiences, just keep it to yourself until that person's ready to hear it or wants to hear it. And that certainly spoke to me, Celeste. I guess the last thing to ask you before we sign off would be, where's the best place for people to connect with you and some of the places to go for the resources that you've talked about and are coming our way?
So they can just go to the website, celestehedley.com, which is where I put a lot of the blogs. And I work really hard to make sure every single study is footnoted. So if they're interested in where all of this, the underpinnings of all this is, they can absolutely find that in the footnotes. I am a wonky person. I like to read a good research report. So I really like turning people to the original research. But you know, I think that there is a lot of data out there. There's a lot of information out there. It just doesn't feel right. It's counterintuitive, and so we often ignore it. Oh, the last thing I would say is one of the most common complaints I get, in fact, I saw this as a comment on the TED Talk, was if I followed Celeste Headlee's advice, I'd never get to talk at all. So let me just say I am super not worried about that. I am not worried about people not talking. You're gonna talk. Yeah, it's okay.
I think based on the guidelines though, it just limits the talking from the incessant babble that we were tempted to do. And if we can implement some of the behaviors and principles, we'll talk a little bit less. We'll have better conversations overall. Yes, we're still going to talk because we love doing it, like you say, about ourselves. Don't worry, that urge is going to still come through. It's going to be stronger than these rules, unfortunately. But introducing some of these rules and adhering to them, it's going to put us in a better position. So the link in the show notes will be to Celeste's website. I will pop the link to the book that I read, which was We Need to Talk, How to Have Conversations That Matter, to Amazon, and you can get involved there. Please take a screenshot, share it in your Instagram story, pop it in the WhatsApp group, share it with friends that need to have better conversations. If you're watching on YouTube, then please subscribe to the channel for weekly posts, and I'll be back to speak to you all again next week.